After supper, the prisoners had an hour in their cells before lights out. Schofield slid a Bible out from under the mattress on his bunk and spent the time reading. After what the former minister had done and the disbelief he'd expressed, the kid thought he probably wouldn't have wanted to read the good book. But obviously, that wasn't the case. Maybe Schofield was looking for some loophole, the kid mused, some way of believing again and escaping damnation. The kid didn't think he'd find it. When the lights went out and stifling darkness closed in, awareness of all that stone and metal between him and the outside world sunk in and made the kid's nerves stretch taut. The kid thought Schofield was actually sort of right about one thing. The whole world might not be hell, but being locked up in prison sure was. The worst part, at least starting out, was the sheer monotony of existence inside the prison walls. The same things happened at the same times every day, from breakfast to supper to lights out. The kid's job in the laundry was to stir the big vats of hot water where uniforms and bedding were washed. The work was mind-numbing and miserable. The heat and humidity made it hard to breathe and ensured that he spent his days covered in sweat. The stink of the harsh lye soap stung his nostrils. A week passed with nothing unusual happening. He made the acquaintance of a few men he worked with, but no one approached him about an escape attempt. That wasn't really a surprise, since Hughes and Culhane were of the opinion the gang didn't tell their targets beforehand what was going on. It was more likely Lupo hadn't had any idea he was about to escape until the breakout was already in progress. Secrecy was the only way to make sure no one went to the prison authorities and spilled the truth. All the kid could do was tend to the job he'd been given and wait. He didn't like it. He was used to action, but he had no choice. A week later, things changed abruptly. He was assigned to work in the fields. Each morning, prisoners were loaded into enclosed wagons after their ankles were shackled together. The wagons took them to the fields, where they clambered out awkwardly and were given canvas sacks. Their job was to pick cotton, something the kid had never done in his life. He quickly discovered it was miserable, back-breaking work, spending long hours bent over in the sun, fingers growing raw from handling the plants. Schofield was part of the same detail, and the kid finally understood why the man was so tanned and weathered. He had been doing this for nearly his entire sentence, Schofield explained to him as they labored side by side. In East Texas, not that far inland from the Gulf Coast, the growing season was long, and a lot of fields were planted in cotton. The prison even had its own gin to process the crop. A dozen mounted guards, armed with shotguns and rifles, watched each group of 50 prisoners. Schofield told the kid a number of convicts had been shot while trying to get away. Everybody knew the futility of it, but sometimes the temptation to make a stumbling run for freedom was just too much to resist. As hard as the work was, the kid preferred being outside to being stuck in the prison laundry. He wondered if Warden Jennings was responsible for getting him transferred to the work detail, or if it was something that would have happened on the same schedule anyway. It didn't really matter, of course. He was there, and there he would probably stay until the gang made its move. If the gang made its move. If the gang really existed. Doubts about that assailed the kid from time to time. If Culhane and Hughes were wrong, all he was going through was for nothing. One morning, he was surprised to see Hank Cushman being loaded into one of the wagons bound for the cotton fields. Cushman hadn't been one of the pickers, and with his big brawny frame, he wasn't built for the job. But the convicts went where they were told to go and did what they were told to do, so the kid supposed somebody in authority had decided Cushman needed to be picking cotton for a while. That thought started suspicion percolating in the kid's brain. Without being obvious about it, he kept an eye on Cushman for the next few days. The big man rode in a different wagon and didn't approach him while they were in the fields. The kid was starting to wonder if he ought to make an attempt to talk to Cushman. Every day, a trustee drove out to the fields in an open wagon with a couple of water barrels loaded in the back. Several times during the day, the guards allowed the convicts to gather around those barrels and get a drink, passing around a wooden dipper among them. After laboring in the hot sun, the men were always parched with thirst, so there was usually considerable crowding going on. The men moved back quickly, though, when Cushman came up and reached for the dipper. The man who had just filled it with water handed it to Cushman without complaint. Cushman drank, the muscles in his corded throat working as he swallowed. Then he callously tossed the dipper on the ground as he turned away. Behind him, one of the convicts picked it up and wiped away the dirt sticking to its wet surface. Cushman saw the kid looking at him, grinned, and walked over to him.
What's the matter with you? You don't like what I just did?
No, I don't give a damn. I already got my drink.
You're that train robber, aren't you? Keen.
That's right.
I'm Hank Cushman.
I know.
Then you know you'd be smart to steer clear of me.
I don't go looking for trouble, Cushman. But I don't step around it when it's in my way either.
You don't?
No. I go over it.
Cushman took that just the way the kid meant it, as a challenge. His huge hands knotted into fists. For a second, the kid thought Cushman was going to take a swing at him. The guards thought so, too. One of them suddenly moved his horse closer.
Hey there, you two! Back off from each other, now!
Cushman looked like he wanted to defy the order, but the guard had a Winchester pointed in his general direction. After a couple of heartbeats, he grinned at the kid again.
Another time.
Sure.
I said move!
Don't get a burr under your saddle, Hagen. I'm going.
I won't put up with anything from you. You remember that.
So that was Bert Hagen, the kid thought. Until that moment, he hadn't known which of the guards was the one involved in Lupo's escape, if you could call it that. Hagen was a big man, not as big as Cushman, but nobody else around there was. With a long, mean, horse-like face and a few wisps of pale hair sticking out from under the broad-brimmed hat the guards wore when they were out in the fields, the kid felt an instinctive dislike for Hagen. But to be honest, he felt that way about most of the men inside the prison walls, guards and convicts alike. Still, he was glad to know which one was Hagen. He could keep a closer eye on the man. Several more days passed. Cushman continued to work in the cotton fields, but kept his distance from the kid. Schofield was usually somewhere close by. Knowing what the man had done to land himself in prison, the kid couldn't bring himself to actually like Schofield, but he felt sorry for him in a way. The guilt Schofield must feel over his actions would be enough to drive a man crazy if he wasn't already. Ike Calvert wasn't the usual trustee who brought the water wagon out to the fields. The kid's eyes narrowed with suspicion when he saw the weaselly little trustee hauling back on the wagon's reins. Calvert being assigned to the job might be entirely innocent, or it could be the opening move in the game the kid had been sent to crash. When the guards called for a water break, the convicts left their sacks stuffed with cotton bowls on the ground and headed for the wagons. Even though the leg irons limited their movement, they moved along pretty quickly. A great thirst gripped them. The kid had been picking fairly close to where the wagon had stopped and was almost there when somebody rammed hard against his left shoulder from behind. His feet tangled in the chains and he went down, sprawling on the dirt between the rows of cotton plants. He rolled over and looked up in time to see Hank Cushman standing over him, his fist about to strike. As Cushman went in for the attack, the kid rolled hard to the side, barely avoiding his fist. Still vulnerable, he rolled back the other way. He didn't want those clubbed fists smashing into the back of his head. Bringing his hands up, he grabbed Cushman and pulled him to the ground. Cushman was an experienced brawler and recovered almost instantly. He swung his legs toward the kid, lifting them high so the chain hanging between them dropped neatly over the kid's head. Just before the chain snapped tight against the kid's neck, he managed to get his hands up and block the metal links. He hung onto them desperately, knowing it would take Cushman only a second to crush his throat if the big convict got the leverage he needed. The kid threw himself backward so he landed on top of Cushman. His hands were all that was protecting his throat, so he twisted and jabbed a knee at Cushman's groin. Cushman let up on the pressure on the chain. Muscles in the kid's arms and shoulders bunched as he shoved it up and away from him. He quickly rolled again to put some distance between him and his attacker, but it wasn't far enough. Cushman leaped after him, and they crashed together, landing in a row of cotton plants and crushing them. Cushman hammered punches at the kid's head and body. The kid blocked most of the blows. Some got through and landed with stunning force. Cushman's mallet-like fist clipped the side of his head, and the impact made the whole world spin in the wrong direction for a second. The kid knew he had to do something or Cushman might beat him to death. It couldn't be part of the gang's plan, he thought wildly. Cushman wasn't trying just to put him in the infirmary. He was trying to kill him. The kid hooked a left and a right into Cushman's midsection. It was like hitting a wall. He sent a jab against Cushman's jaw, but might as well have punched a rock. The big man didn't seem to have any vulnerabilities. One of Cushman's fists dug into the kid's belly. In desperation, the kid cupped his hands and slapped them as hard as he could against Cushman's ears. That tactic finally made him heave upright. He pawed at his ears and got to his feet. The kid quickly got back to his feet and snapped out a kick and drove the heel of his boot against Cushman's left knee. The convict staggered as his left leg folded up underneath him. Seeing that he was finally getting the upper hand, the kid went in for an uppercut to Cushman's jaw. Cushman's head snapped back, and he stumbled away another step. The kid lowered his head and shoulders and drove forward, plowing into the man. Cushman went over backward and toppled to the ground. Instantly, the kid landed on top of him and drove a knee toward his opponent's groin. The kid pushed himself to his feet. Cushman, curled up around the agony gripping him, was still huge, but all the fight had gone out of him. The kid glanced around and saw the other convicts herded together about 20 yards away, well covered with rifles and shotguns. Hagen and another guard were standing near the scene of the fight.
Why didn't you put a stop to this ruckus?
What, ruin the show? When two of you idiots start wailing away on each other, we generally let it run its course, unless it looks like somebody's fixing to get killed. You and Cushman didn't look to be in any danger of that. Although, I bet Cushman's hurting so bad right now, he wishes he was dead.
The kid turned away and walked over to the water wagon and leaned on the lowered tailgate.
You all right, Keith?
Yeah, I'll be fine. Just bruised and sore in the morning.
You're lucky. Cushman's an animal.
Yeah, I got that idea.
A couple of you men grab Cushman and drag him into the shade of the wagon. I don't know if he'll be able to work anymore today.
Hagen looked at the kid.
If he can't, you'll have to take up the slack for him, Keen.
He started the fight.
I don't give a damn about that. All I know is that at the end of the day, there'd better be as many full sacks of cotton as I'm expecting. Understand?
Yeah.
The kid reached for the wooden dipper, filled it, and dumped the water over his head before refilling it and drinking. Two of the convicts dragged Cushman under the wagon as they'd been ordered. The other men were allowed to crowd around the wagon for their turn at the water barrels. The kid handed over the dipper and moved out of the way. Schofield came up to him.
You made yourself a bad enemy today, Waco.
Cushman's the one who came after me. I reckon he already had his mind made up the two of us were enemies.
Maybe so, but he'll feel like he has to kill you now. The only way anybody in here will ever respect him again is if you're dead.
People have wanted me dead before.
I'm sure they have, but trouble can come at you from any direction in prison without much warning. I try to help you keep an eye out for it.
I'm obliged to you for that, John.
With the excitement over, the convicts got back to work. The guards allowed Cushman to stay under the water wagon the rest of the day. When they were loading up to head back to the prison late that afternoon, Hagen ordered him placed in the back of the wagon with the barrels.
Take him to the infirmary. I'll send a man along with you to keep an eye on him.
Sure, boss.
The kid didn't think that boss meant anything. Some of the prisoners addressed all the guards that way. Bruises stood out on the kid's face, and he knew his body was black and blue from Cushman's pounding fists. The fight had convinced him Cushman wasn't working with the gang. Cushman had been trying too hard to kill him. But having the big man as an enemy was liable to complicate things. The kid hoped it wouldn't scare the gang off and decide that they didn't want to break him out of the penitentiary after all. During the hour, the lights were still lit after supper. The kid was surprised when footsteps came along the cell block. Several men stopped in front of the cell he shared with Schofield. He was even more surprised when he recognized one of them as Warden Preston Jennings.
Step up here, Mr. Keene.
What is it?
The kid stood up from his bunk and approached the bars.
It's been reported to me that you were involved in a fight in the cotton fields today.
Cushman jumped me.
Keep a civil tongue in your head when you're talking to the warden, Keene.
I've spoken to all the guards who were there, and they agree Cushman provoked the fight and you were only defending yourself. For that reason, I'm going to recommend no additional charges be filed against you.
Charges? Charges for what?
Murder. Hank Cushman died a short time ago.
What the hell? I didn't do anything that would have killed him.
I'm warning you, Keene.
Calm down, Lawrence. Dr. Kendrick informed me that Cushman died from internal bleeding. If he hadn't been left lying out there in the field for the rest of the day after he was injured, it might not have happened. So all the blame doesn't lie on you, Keene. As I said, it's been established that you fought back in self-defense. However, the final decision isn't up to me. I'll recommend to the local prosecutor that you not be brought to trial, but that's all I can do.
All right. Thanks, Warden. I really didn't mean to kill him.
You'll carry on with your usual activities until I receive the final determination in this matter.
With that, he turned and walked back up the cell block with Lawrence and the other guards accompanying him. The kid shook his head slowly and went over to sit down again on his bunk.
I heard all that.
Looks like you won't have to be watching over your shoulder for Cushman after all.
I guess not.
The wheels of the kid's brain turned over rapidly. He had speculated from the first that Dr. Simon Kendrick might be involved with the gang, and what had happened to Cushman made him even more suspicious. He supposed it was possible Cushman had died just the way Hendrick had said, but the kid had his doubts. If he was being targeted by the gang, they wouldn't want him killed by a vengeful Cushman before a breakout could be arranged. It would be much easier to get rid of Cushman while they had the chance. Kendrick could have killed him somehow, and since the doctor was the person responsible for determining the cause of death, the theory fit together, the kid thought as he stretched out on his bunk and rolled to face the wall. And if it was right, it was more proof, as if anybody needed it, just how ruthless the gang was. Tired and sore though he was, the kid had a little trouble falling asleep that night. Within a week, the kid's bruises faded and the aches went away. He had gotten used to picking cotton, although he knew it was something he would never enjoy, no matter how long he did it. He was also getting restless. He didn't like being locked up. He had volunteered for the task and was ready for it to be over, even though it would likely mean more danger. Ike Calvert hadn't driven the water wagon since the day of the fight with Cushman, but he showed up again, bringing the vehicle with its pair of water barrels to a halt on the dirt lane running through the fields. Calvert climbed down from the seat and stood to the side, rolling a cigarette while the convicts gathered around the wagon to get their drinks. The kid wasn't really surprised when Calvert sauntered over to him.
There's a rumor going round that Cushman's partner's gonna jump you during chow tonight. They got knives and they plan to cut you to pieces for what you've done to Hank.
That was an accident, and Cushman started the fight anyway.
That don't matter none to them. They gonna kill you, Keen, unless you get out of here today.
Yeah? How in the hell am I gonna do that?
He nodded toward the guards, who were watching the prisoners closely as usual.
You might be surprised. There are people on the outside who are interested in you, Keen. All you gotta do is play along and you'll be looked out for.
It was a little different from the approach they had taken with Quint Lupo, the kid thought. No longer doubting such a gang really existed, and Calvert was connected to it. Bert Hagen was one of the guards assigned to the cotton fields, too. The kid had noticed. He figured that wasn't an accident.
What in blazes are you talking about, Calvert?
There's a gun in the bottom of the water barrel closest to the tailgate.
Are you trying to get me killed?
I'm trying to save your life, you damn fool. Listen to me. Something's going to happen in a few minutes. When it does, jump in the wagon, grab that gun, and shoot one of the guards off his horse. Then you'll be able to jump in the saddle and light a shuck out of here before anybody knows what's going on.
That'll be a neat trick with my ankles shackled together.
Here.
Without appearing to do anything, Calvert's hand moved slightly at his side. The kid felt something metal pressed into his palm.
Is that a key to the irons?
Yeah. Don't ask me how I got it.
I wasn't planning to. Is this for real?
Damn right it is. I got contacts on the outside. Men who can use an hombre like you. They'll be around when you make your break. Join up with them, and they'll see to it you get out of here free and clear.
Yeah, free and clear with every lawman in the state on my trail.
If you'd rather sit in a cell with that loco sky pilot for the next 20 years, wondering when he's gonna snap and murder you in your sleep, that's up to you.
Guns fully loaded?
Six in the wheel.
Sounds good. What's this distraction you're talking about?
You'll know it when it happens. Just be ready to move. Ball won't take long to get started as soon as I give the high sign. Are you in?
The kid hesitated, but only long enough to make the reaction look real. Then he nodded.
I'm in.
Good. There's just a couple more things. When you jump up in the wagon, give me a clout on the head. Don't bust my skull open or nothing like that, but make it look real. I don't want any of the guards thinking I had any part of this.
What's the other thing?
Don't shoot Hagen.
It's like that, is it?
Don't ask questions. Just do what I told you.
Sure, sure. Now, I've just got one more thing.
What's that?
This better not be some kind of double cross. If you're setting me up, Calvert, I'll make sure you're dead before I go down.
Don't worry about that. He'll see, Keen. Just be ready.
The kid nodded and moved away from Calvert, but didn't stray far from the water wagon. He watched Calvert climb back onto the wagon seat and lift his right arm to scratch vigorously underneath it. That was probably the signal. Somebody had to be watching them through field glasses or a telescope. A few more minutes went by, and the kid started thinking the guards would order the prisoners back to work. If the gang was going to make a move, it needed to be soon. The kid's head snapped around. A column of smoke and dust rose into the air about 200 yards away. He knew a fence of some sort surrounded the fields, although he hadn't been close enough to get a good look at it. From the sound of the blast, Somebody had just made themselves a gate where there wasn't one.
Everybody down!
One of the guards swung his rifle toward the startled prisoners.
Get down on the ground, damn it!
Most of the convicts dropped to the dirt between the rows of cotton plants, wanting to be well out of the line of fire if any shooting started. A few began trying to shuffle away, futile though it might be. The kid threw himself to the ground, but didn't just lie there. He reached down to his ankles, thrust the key Calvert had given him into the lock of one of the leg irons, and twisted it. The shackle opened. Moving swiftly, the kid unlocked the other one and kicked free. He rolled over and surged to his feet.
Hey, King, stop!
The kid leaped onto the back of the water wagon, plunged his right hand into the barrel, reaching for the bottom. His fingers touched the hard round metal of a revolver cylinder. Sliding his hand along it, he found the gun butt and grabbed it. The bullet from the rifle shot punched through the water barrel, missing the kid's arm by a few inches as he pulled out the gun. The kid straightened and twisted. He didn't want to kill the guard racing toward him on horseback who was just doing his job. He aimed for the man's arm, thinking it was better to risk crippling him than killing him. He didn't have to do either. As the guard galloped past John Schofield, the former minister leaped up and grabbed him, jerking him out of the saddle. The guard tumbled to the ground. From the corner of his eye, the kid saw half a dozen riders galloping across the field from the site of the explosion. The gang was coming to break him out, he realized. Flame lanced from the guns in their hands as they traded shots with the guards. The kid lunged toward the front of the wagon. Calvert was cowering on the seat. As the trustee had told him to do, the kid swung a punch with his left fist, smashing it against the side of Calvert's head hard enough to make the man slump to the floorboard. Schofield stumbled up to the back of the wagon.
Take me with you, Waco! Take me with you!
He clambered onto the tailgate and struggled to his feet, thinking the kid was going to steal the wagon. Just as Schofield rose, one of the guards lined his rifle sights on the kid and pulled the trigger. The slug caught Schofield in the back instead. Schofield slumped forward but caught himself on one of the water barrels.
Waco!
Sorry, John.
The light went out of Schofield's eyes and he pitched lifelessly to the side. The kid threw himself from the wagon and landed in the saddle of the horse belonging to the guard Schofield had pulled from the saddle. The guards had been forced to retreat from the gang's attack, though they outnumbered the outlaws. The kid jerked his mount around and thundered toward the charging gunmen. He saw that they were all masked. One of the guards spurred out, evidently attempting to cut him off. The kid was surprised to recognize the guard as Bert Hagen. He had suspected all along that Hagen was part of the gang, and what Calvert had told him about not shooting Hagen pretty much confirmed that. Then the kid realized the outlaws were aiming high, making it look good so none of the other guards would suspect Hagen was in on the escape attempt. The kid played his part in that, throwing a couple of slugs in Hagen's general direction, but aiming well wide of him. The kid jerked his horse to the right to avoid Hagen. Suddenly, two of the masked men closed in on either side of him.
Kane?
Yeah?
Pick it up!
Husett said the Rangers would have a man somewhere close by the prison all the time to follow the gang when they broke the kid out. The kid hoped that whoever had the assignment hadn't fallen down on the job. The explosion should have alerted anybody that something was going on. It would have been heard inside the prison. A large force of guards was probably on the way to find out what had happened and round up any prisoners who were trying to get away. The other masked men fell in behind the kid and his two escorts. They twisted in their saddles and fired behind them to keep the guards back. The fence appeared in front of them with a gaping hole blasted by dynamite. The kid and the masked men raced through the opening. The men didn't slow down until several miles were between themselves and the prison. They seemed to know the roads very well and didn't hesitate as their mounts lunged forward. The kid had a good sense of direction, but once their route plunged into the thick East Texas forest covering the landscape, he wasn't sure which way they were going. Tall pines and tangled underbrush crowded in on either side of the trail, blocking off most of the sky. The growth stifled even the slightest breath of air, too. The kid found himself sweating through his prison uniform, and it wasn't just from nerves. Finally, a big, bulky man crowded into the lead and raised his hand to signal a halt. As the other riders reined in, the leader turned his horse toward the kid and reached up to pull the bandana mask from his face. He had craggy features dominated by a powerful jaw and a ragged gray mustache. Despite his brutal appearance, intelligence gleamed in his eyes as he studied the kid.
You'd be Waco Keene.
I'd better be, hadn't I? If you went to all that trouble and broke the wrong man out of prison, you'd probably shoot me right here and now.
I just might have died. So answer the question, Pronto.
I'm Waco Keene. Satisfied?
Yeah, I reckon. I wanted to hear it for myself. But you wouldn't have that gun if Calvert hadn't told you where it was. I don't think that little rat would have made that bad a mistake.
What did Calvert tell you before all hell broke loose?
Well, there wasn't time for him to tell me much. He told me the gun was in the water barrel and somebody was coming to help get me out of prison. He said he knew people who had a use for me.
And you went along with it just like that?
Who the hell wouldn't? The only thing I cared about was that it was a chance to get out of there. I don't like being locked up.
Not many folks do.
Don't you reckon we ought to get moving again? There's bound to be a whole passel of guards on our trail.
You'd be surprised. We know these woods pretty well and can give just about anybody the slip in them. But we'll be on our way again as soon as the horses have rested a little more. It won't do us any good to ride them into the ground now, will it?
You fellas know who I am, but I don't know a blasted thing about any of you, not even your names.
And that's the way it's gotta be for now. You'll find out everything you need to know later on, when we get where we're going.
The other men had lowered their bandanas. Without being too obvious about it, the kid took a good look at them. They were all hard-faced gunmen, the sort of outlaws he had clashed with frequently in the past. After a few more minutes, the leader waved the group of riders into motion again. Eventually, they left the trail they had been following and started along a narrower one. The men were forced to ride single file, three men in front of the kid, three men behind. The gloom was so thick inside the forest it was almost like night, deep and dark and foreboding. The thickets on either side of the trail were impenetrable. He couldn't have gone anywhere, even if he wanted to. The trip through the forest seemed endless.
Are you sure you boys aren't lost?
Keep your shirt on. We know where we're going.
It's going to be dark soon.
Doesn't matter. We'll get there.
The kid understood how the gang had been able to throw off pursuit in the past. They had twisted and turned so much in that wilderness, splashing across little streams every so often, not even bloodhounds were able to follow them. That meant whoever the rangers had watching the prison probably hadn't been able to pick up their trail either. And that meant he really was on his own now. He wasn't going to be able to get in touch with the contact man. It was one of the many things that could have gone wrong with the ranger's plan. The kid had to stay alive until he could figure out his next move. Darkness settled down, and as the kid expected, it was nearly complete inside the forest. If his horse hadn't been able to plod along behind the animal ahead of it, the kid would have had no idea which way to go. The men rode for at least an hour after night had fallen before they suddenly broke out of the trees and emerged into a clearing. After the Stygian blackness of the forest, the silvery glow of the moon and stars seemed almost as bright as daylight. Blinking, the kid looked around and saw they were on a wide, hard-packed road. The leader turned his horse to the right, and the others surrounded the kid and followed. They were taking no chances on him deciding to cut and run now that he was free of the prison. It was like they considered him an investment and didn't want to lose him. A tree-lined lane appeared ahead of them, on the left, the first sign of human habitation the kid had seen in a while. And he wasn't surprised when the leader turned his horse into the lane and rode toward a large house at the end of it. As they came close, the kid could tell it was an old plantation manor in poor repair. The leader reined in and dismounted and motioned for the others to do likewise. As the kid brought his mount to a halt, several of the men surrounded him, guns drawn.
There's no need to worry. I told you, I'm grateful to you boys. I'm not going to cause any trouble for you.
There are certain ways we do things, and it won't do you any good to argue about them. Get down from that horse, Kane. Hand over your gun.
I don't much like being unarmed.
You don't have any choice in the matter. Shuck the iron or this ends right here and now.
Take it easy. Take it easy. I said I didn't like it. Didn't say I wouldn't do it.
Moving carefully so that none of the men would be tempted to get trigger happy, he took the gun from his waistband, passed it over to the nearest of the outlaws, and then dismounted.
All right.
The leader lowered his gun but didn't pouch it.
Now come with me.
The kid followed the man into the house, which was dimly lit by oil lamps. The place's disrepair was more apparent inside with its frayed rugs and stained wallpaper. The leader took him along a hallway, and as they approached a pair of open double doors at the end of the corridor, they passed an alcove. The kid glanced in there, but the alcove was too shadowy for him to see anything except a painting that hung on the wall. It seemed to be a family portrait, with a man standing behind a chair where a woman sat with a child on her lap. The kid couldn't make out any more details before he was past the alcove and moving through the door the big man held open for him. The smell of mold was strong in the air, and as the kid entered the room, he saw why. The roof of the library had leaked, and the books had gotten wet. The kid's gaze turned instantly toward the desk dominating the room. The man sitting behind it rose to his feet to greet the newcomers. He was tall, slender almost to the point of gauntness, and well-dressed in a brown tweed suit. pale skin of his face seemed a pallid contrast to the shock of dark hair that topped it. Deep-set eyes peered across the desk at the kid as the man smiled.
Waco Keene. Welcome to my home. My name is Alexander Gray.
A while back, the kid had spent some time in West Texas in a place called Rattlesnake Valley. While there, he'd seen more of those venomous reptiles than he'd ever wanted to. He got the same feeling looking at Alexander Gray that he'd had when he confronted those rattlers. Even though the man was smiling and congenial, lurking under the surface was a cold, inhuman menace. When Gray held out a long-fingered hand, the kid was reminded of a rattlesnake's wedge-shaped head poised to strike. He stepped forward and shook Gray's hand anyway, keeping his instinctive revulsion well concealed.
You must be the boss of this outfit.
That's right.
Gray released the kid's hand. He motioned toward a leather chair in front of the desk.
Have a seat, Brattle. Bring us some drinks.
Sure thing, boss.
The man who had brought the kid to the room turned to the bar on one side of the room. As the kid settled in the chair, he felt like he had wandered into a stage play. The other men were familiar with their roles and had performed them numerous times before. He was the newcomer, the understudy forced by circumstances into a role of his own.
You weren't injured when my men liberated you from your imprisonment, I hope.
I'm fine. Just mighty glad to be out of there.
Of course you are. No man likes to be locked up. In case you're wondering what this is all about, our organization specializes in helping men with unique talents, such as yourself. Men who can put those talents to much better use outside prison. You have quite a reputation, Mr. Keene, and it would truly be a shame not to let you do the thing you do best.
What are you thinking that is?
Why, robbing trains, of course.
The big outlaw called Brattle came over with a couple of brandy snifters, setting them on the desk in front of the kid.
Help yourself.
Letting him pick which drink he wanted was a show of trustworthiness, the kid supposed. He reached for one of the snifters, and Gray took the other.
To our new partnership.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm grateful for your help, no doubt about that. But I don't know that I'm looking for a new partner.
Gray sipped his brandy. The kid couldn't see any reason they would break him out of prison, only to turn around and poison him, so odds were the drink was safe. He took a sip and found it to be quite good. Better than he expected to get in the run-down plantation house.
That's nice, smooth drinking.
Thank you. As for our business arrangement, I'm afraid you don't have much choice where that's concerned, Mr. King. You see, I've invested a considerable amount of money in setting up your escape, and I intend to be paid back for that investment.
I didn't ask you or anybody else to bust me out of prison.
True enough, but now that we have, you owe us, to put it bluntly.
The kid sat there with a frown on his face and didn't say anything for a moment.
I suppose you could look at it that way.
Indeed I do. But there's no need for us to argue. What I have in mind is an arrangement that will prove quite beneficial and lucrative to us both.
Go on.
I have Brattle and a number of other men working for me, but I need someone with more experience in your particular specialty, train robbing.
I've held up quite a few of them.
Oh, I'm aware of that. I did a bit of looking into your history, Mr. Keene. Or should I call you Waco?
Waco's fine.
Because you were born there?
Yep.
You've made some nice hauls from the jobs you've pulled, but you can do even better with my gang backing you up. They're top professionals, and I have contacts among the railroads who will help us spot the best trains to hit. Well, there's no point in risking your life for an express car that's almost empty, is there?
No point at all. What would my share be?
Well, starting out, nothing, I'm afraid. Your share will go toward paying off what you owe me. But later, once you've proven yourself and become a full member of the gang, you'll have a full share, of course. Maybe even a bonus, since I'll be relying heavily on you to help plan the job.
I don't know.
Again, I'm not really giving you a choice. I expect you to cooperate at least until your debt is paid. After that, well, if you truly don't want to be part of our organization, you'll be free to leave. Although, I think you'll be foolish to do so.
It was an easy enough promise for Gray to make, the kid thought. There was no chance any of the men Gray broke out of prison would leave the gang. They were all doomed from the moment they rode away with Gray's men, although none of them had known that. Until now. The kid knew what Gray's plan was, and it was up to him to stop it if he wanted to live.
Since you put it that way, I reckon I'd be a fool not to stick around and see how things play out.
Ah, I knew you'd see it our way. Brattle, show our new partner to his room.
Sure, boss.
The kid stood up from the chair.
I could use something to eat. It's been a long time since that prison breakfast this morning, and it wasn't very good to start with.
Of course. I'll see to it.
How soon do you figure on pulling one of those train robberies you were talking about?
Well, don't worry about that right now. I think we should let any uproar over your escape from prison die down first. That's one of the most important keys to running an operation such as ours. Never rush anything.
You're the boss.
That's right, I am.
From the doorway, Brattle jerked a thumb.
Come on, Waco.
As they went up a curving set of stairs, the kid decided to make some conversation.
I guess you must be Gray Segundo.
Well, that's better than some things I've been called. Sometimes the boss gets it in his head that I'm his butler. I reckon he misses the way things used to be around here. But I ask you, do I look like a damn butler to you?
Not hardly. So is this the boss's old family home or something?
Never mind about that. Just do as you're told and you'll get along fine around here.
All right. That's what I intend to do.
The kid paused as they reached the second floor landing.
Do you reckon I could have that gun back now?
You don't need a gun as long as you're here. When you need one, I'll see that you get it.
He motioned for the kid to follow him down a hallway with a worn carpet runner on the floor. Brattle paused in front of a door, pulled a key from his pocket, and unlocked it.
Starting to feel like I'm back in Huntsville. No gun, guards everywhere, locked doors.
Oh, this place a lot better than prison. You'll see.
The kid went into the room. It was simply furnished with a narrow bed, an old wardrobe, a chair, and a small table with a wash basin and a lamp on it. Brattle scratched a match into life and lit the lamp. Ragged curtains hung over the single window. The kid wondered why Gray didn't have the place fixed up. The gang had made quite a bit of money from its string of robberies. Gray should have been able to afford to restore the place to at least a semblance of its former glory. Unless he didn't want to for some reason. Maybe the kid would learn more about that as the days went on.
There are some clothes in the wardrobe that ought to fit you. Somebody will be up with supper in a little while.
Much obliged.
You'll do all right. Just don't get impatient. Don't get too curious about things that don't concern you. Remember those two things and you won't have any trouble.
Sounds good.
The kid had just finished changing clothes when the key sounded in the lock again. The kid turned toward the door, expecting to see Brattle or one of the other outlaws bringing him the promised meal. The person standing there when the door swung open had a tray with food on it, all right. But she wasn't one of the outlaws. She was a beautiful young woman. The kid's mind flashed back to the Minger Hotel in San Antonio and the day he had found Catherine Lupo standing in the hallway instead of a waiter with his supper. The situation had some parallels, all right. But where Catherine was fair, the young woman in front of him was darker, with ebony hair and skin the color of coffee with a lot of cream in it. She wore a tan blouse and a long brown skirt instead of a traveling outfit, and she had indeed brought food with her, whereas Catherine had shown up with only a plea for the kid's help.
You are Waco Keene, yes?
Yeah, I'm Waco.
She balanced the tray holding his supper with her left hand, while her right dipped into the pocket of her skirt and came up with a small pistol.
Mr. Gray said a gun of this caliber wouldn't kill you unless I shot you in the head or the heart, so I have permission to aim elsewhere. And I will if you try anything funny, Mr. Keene.
The kid held up both hands in surrender, grinning.
Take it easy, mademoiselle. There's no need for gunplay.
Not only am I armed, but there are men within earshot who'll be here in a matter of moments if I cry out for help.
You won't need to. I'm not looking for any trouble.
Back up. Stand over there by the window, please.
He did as she told him, keeping his hands in plain sight as he backed toward the window. Still pointing the gun at him, she carried the tray over to the table and set it down.
You can just leave the dishes there when you're finished. Someone will get them later.
I'm obliged to you. There's just one more thing.
What's that?
You know my name, but I don't know yours.
Her brown eyes flashed for a second as if she were angry. But his charming grin had an effect on her.
I'm Beatrice.
Mighty pleased to make your acquaintance, Miss Beatrice. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of each other.
I'm sure.
She left the room, locking the door behind her. The kid went over to the table and sat down. The plate on the tray held several slices of roast beef, a mound of potatoes, a piece of bread, and some greens. A cup of coffee with wisps of steam curling up from it was next to the plate. Simple fare, to be sure. But it was better than what he'd been getting in prison. He ate eagerly, washing the food down with gulps of the hot coffee. The kid woke up to someone unlocking the door to his room. As he sat up and opened his eyes, He wondered if Beatrice was bringing him breakfast. It was Brattle's ugly face, wearing a leering grin that looked in at him.
Better get up, Keane. We're pulling out.
Pulling out? I just got here last night.
That's right. We've been waiting for things to work out so we could have you with us when we left. We would have made our move to bust you out before we did if that big galoot Cushman hadn't jumped you the very day things were all set up.
The kid had wondered about that since Ike Calvert had brought the water wagon to the fields that day, but hadn't shown up in that job again until the day of the breakout. Based on what Brattle had just told him, there had probably been a gun in the water barrel and the gang waiting to blow the fence up that first day, too. They would have carried out the plan if not for Cushman's interference. The kid was convinced Dr. Kendrick had killed Cushman. None of that, however, cleared up the kid's confusion over Brattle's comment about them leaving the plantation. All he had done to prepare for bed the night before was take off his boots. He swung his legs out of bed.
Where are we going? Or am I not allowed to know that?
I reckon a boss will tell you when he's good and ready. That ain't for me to say.
What about the other clothes in the wardrobe?
Don't worry about them. Somebody will get them.
Beatrice?
The kid followed Brattle out of the room. Brattle stopped and frowned.
Now don't you be worrying or even thinking much about Miss Beatrice.
She belongs to the boss, huh?
Better not say anything like that around him. He won't cotton to it.
Fine. I've never been one for poaching on another man's territory. Sounds sort of funny coming from a train robber, doesn't it?
Brattle didn't say anything. He just glowered darkly and motioned for the kid to follow him. Even before they reached the bottom of the staircase, the kid could tell something was going on. Men hurried here and there, carrying boxes and bags, packing up the house to leave. From the looks of the activity, it wasn't a temporary trip. It struck the kid as someone getting ready to move permanently. If the plantation really was Alexander Gray's ancestral home, as the kid had speculated, he was about to abandon it. The front door was open, and the pallid light of dawn came through the opening. Gray appeared in the doorway, wearing a white suit and a planter's hat.
Ah, good morning, Waco. Sorry to drag you out of bed so early, but we have a long way to go. There's coffee and food in the dining room, but I'm afraid you won't have much time to eat. I want to get the wagons rolling.
Just about all I have is what's on me, so it won't take me any time to pack.
Simplicity, eh? That's a good attitude to take.
Where are we going?
You'll see when we get there. I assume I can count on your discretion.
We're partners, aren't we?
Indeed we are. Come on, I could use a cup of coffee myself.
Gray's jovial, false camaraderie didn't fool the kid for a second. He knew what the man's murderous intentions were. But he put a smile on his face anyway, and went with the ringleader of the gang into the dining room. Beatrice was there waiting.
Good morning, Mr. Keane.
Please, ma'am, call me Waco.
Coffee, Mr. Keane?
Sure.
For you too, Alexander?
I think I have time for that. You met our lovely Beatrice last night, I suppose.
She brought me my supper.
Every home needs the feminine touch. This one was missing that for a long time, but now that Beatrice is here...
So, Beatrice was a newcomer too. That was interesting, the kid thought, although he didn't see how it would impact his mission.
Of course we're leaving, but when we settle in at the new place, I'm sure she'll make a home of it as well, won't you, dear?
I'll do my best, Alexander.
After eating some hotcakes and bacon and gulping down some coffee... The kid turned to Gray.
If you need me to help with anything, I'd be glad to.
Thanks, but I believe we're about ready to go. You'll leave with Beatrice, Brattle, and the others. I have one more chore to finish up before I go. Come.
They went outside, where the kid saw all the horses had been saddled. In addition, a buggy and two covered wagons were parked in front of the house. Drivers were already waiting on the wagon seats. Beatrice came out of the house wearing a brown jacket over her blouse that matched her skirt. Brattle offered her his arm.
Let me help you, Miss Beatrice.
Thank you.
She allowed him to assist her in climbing into the buggy. Brattle turned to look at the kid and jerked a thumb at the horse he'd ridden the day before.
Mount up, Keane.
The kid turned his head to glance at Gray, but the ringleader had already gone back into the house. With nothing to do except mount, as he'd been told, the kid swung into the saddle and brought his horse alongside the buggy, where Brattle had settled onto the seat next to Beatrice and had hold of the reins.
You're leading the way?
That's right. Don't go wandering off. The boys wouldn't like it.
I'm not going anywhere except where you go.
Brattle nodded curtly. He slapped the reins against the backs of the two horses hitched to the buggy, and the vehicle began rolling along the lane away from the plantation house. The two wagons lurched into motion behind it. Half a dozen riders, including the kid, flanked the wagons. Brattle led the way to the road and turned in the opposite direction they had come from the night before. In the daylight, the kid could tell it was north. The road ran fairly straight, but had some long curves that soon had the plantation out of sight behind them. For some reason, the kid looked back. Glancing over his shoulder, he stiffened in the saddle as he saw billows of smoke rising over the trees. The smoke was starkly black against the pale early morning sky. He could tell from its location that the plantation house was ablaze, and knew what the last chore was Alexander Gray had lingered behind to complete. The buggy, driven by Brattle, finally came to a halt in front of a large house, reminding the kid of a heap of big rocks. Gray was riding alongside the kid as they approached the place.
It's actually an old stone ranch house where no one has lived for several years. A drought wiped out the herd of the man who owned it. The county took it for taxes, and no one has bought it since then. Conditions are just now starting to improve in this area.
Still looks pretty dry to me.
The brown grass, dead flowers, and wilted look of the trees offered stark testimony to the effects of months with little or no rain. For the past week, the wagons and riders had been traveling north and west, swinging wide around Dallas and Fort Worth into an area Gray had said was known as the Cross Timbers, a mixture of rolling wooded hills, broad grassy plains, rocky ridges, and brush-choked draws. Earlier in the day, the group had traveled through a valley where a small, almost dried-up creek ran, fording it without difficulty. From there, they had climbed gradually to the wide plateau where Brattle had now stopped the buggy. Distant vistas opened up in places along the edge of the plateau, but for the most part, the terrain was flat and dotted with clumps of low-growing cactus. Stretches of hard white rock created the hard surface. The kid rested his hands on his saddle horn and leaned forward to ease tired muscles.
We're not going to be staying here permanent-like, then.
Hey, we'll have to wait and see.
The ringleader had replaced his planter's hat with a black Stetson picked up at the general store in a small town where the group had stopped for supplies.
It all depends on how our operation proceeds.
Gray had gotten the kid a hat, too, a flat-crowned brown Stetson. The kid thumbed it back.
Sooner or later, you're going to have to tell me exactly what we're doing.
It'll be sooner than you think, now that we're here.
Gray turned to the buggy.
How do you like the place, Beatrice?
It's almost as large as the plantation house. Are you sure no one lives here?
Positive. I had the situation checked out thoroughly before I decided on this as our destination. Come on, I want to get settled in before nightfall.
They rode past a small stone storage building next to a windmill and a stock tank with a low stone wall around it. Obviously, there was a lot of rock in the area. Even the house had thick stone pillars flanking its entrance. The place reminded the kid of the old castles he had visited in Europe when he was traveling as a youngster with his mother and stepfather.
There's a settlement about 3 miles to the northwest. We'll avoid it as much as possible. We don't want to draw any more attention to ourselves than necessary.
So this is our hideout. We won't be pulling any jobs right around here. Best to stay respectful where you live.
You're starting to understand, Waco. I knew you were an intelligent man.
The wagon drivers followed a path around the place toward a barn and other outbuildings sitting to the right of the main house. Brattle hopped down from the buggy and turned to help Beatrice, but Gray had already dismounted and beaten him to it. He smiled at her as he took her hand and helped her down from the vehicle.
Welcome to your new home, my dear.
He gave a gracious wave with his other hand and led her to the thick wooden door. Gray hadn't told the kid to go around back with the other men, so he stuck close to the ringleader. Hot, musty air drifted out when Gray opened the door. Despite the air of abandonment about the place, the old ranch house appeared to be in better shape than the one on the plantation, the one Alexander Gray had torched as they left. Gray hadn't said anything about the blaze, and neither had Brattle or any of the other men. Gray and Beatrice went into the house, and the kid and Brattle followed. The interior of the big stone pile was dark and gloomy, reminding the kid again of European castles. However, enough sunlight peeked through the gaps around the dusty curtains over the windows for them to find their way around the rooms. Large, heavy pieces of furniture loomed here and there, obviously left behind when the cattleman who built the house abandoned it. The kid listened for the chittering and scampering of vermin, but didn't hear any, which surprised him. The house had to be well built if it had kept out rats and mice during the years it had been deserted.
Excellent. This will do just fine.
I'll take a look at the kitchen.
Maybe I'd better have a look around too, boss, just to make sure the place is as empty as you think it is.
That's a good idea. Take Waco with you.
How about a gun?
You won't need one. There ain't been any Indian trouble around here for 20 years or more.
I didn't say anything about Indians.
Anything short of a Comanche war party I can handle by myself.
The kid shrugged and went with Brattle on a quick tour of the house. The other rooms had furniture in them, too. Moving in wasn't going to be difficult. Cleaning up might be, though. When they came back to the kitchen to report the house was indeed empty, Beatrice was standing in the center of the room with her hands on her hips and a determined expression on her face.
This place is going to take a lot of scrubbing, from the floors to the ceiling. All the bedding will have to be changed and washed, too. I'll build a fire in the stove. Brattle, can you fetch water from the well?
Yes, ma'am. Come on, Keen. You can lend a hand.